Good morning again, and thanks for being here. You can now give your opening comments.
Okay, thank you so much for having me. I just want to start off by saying it is such an honor to even be considered, and so thank you all for getting me to this point and considering me today. For those of you who I don't know, my name is Stacia Nelson, and I thought I'd just start out by giving you a little bit more of an in-depth about my background professionally and personally, and then we can go into questions. So I actually started my career here. This is my old stomping grounds. I was the education policy lobbyist for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And when I first began at the chamber, education policy was actually a pretty small priority for them. And so they kind of threw it to the new girl. But within the first year, the board actually decided that education policy was a top concern, right up there with healthcare and taxes. And so I had the unique opportunity to do a lot of research and work with local officials and elected officials and communities on how to address really important issues like the achievement gap, STEM education, and education quality. From there, I went to corporate world. Sorry, I'm a little nervous. I haven't done this in a while. I went into the corporate world, and so I worked for various different companies, Cambria, Target, and now I own my own company. And during that time, I have really focused my career in communications and public relations, and specifically in reputation management. So a lot of what I do is help companies to identify what their reputation risks are and address those risks and mitigate against those risks, and if those risks come to light, how to respond. And I've served on several different boards, four different boards. Most recently was the Wyndham Community Council. The Wyndham community is a community in Southwest Minneapolis. And I was the chair of that board, which was not my intention. I actually joined the board and wanted to be the event planner to plan some fun things for kids in the community. But when I first started, I learned that they actually had a lot of conflict on the board, and they asked me to try to step up as chair to help resolve those conflicts. So I ended up doing that. But in addition to helping to resolve those conflicts, it was my honor to set the three-year plan. And within the three-year plan, we had to decide our priorities. One of the priorities that I'm proud that we focused on is to encourage more underrepresented people in the community to start joining in the community discussions. And by actually putting real dollars that taxpayers pay into these communities behind that to create outreach coordinators to bring people like renters, people of color, and those who are lower income to the table, because most of them don't usually come. So that's just one recent example of how I have addressed those gaps. Just on a personal level, I love education. I spent a lot of my career working on education, and this is a great opportunity to rejoin that conversation in a very meaningful way. I'm a first-generation college graduate, and paid my way through undergrad and grad school. And so tuition cost is a real issue for me because I'm still paying for my education, and something that's really near and dear to me. So I think what I bring to the board is probably a unique perspective in being a woman and someone who has put my way through school, someone who has a reputation management background, and a real love of education policy. And with that, I'll open it up for questions.
Thank you. Our first question is going to be from Dan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Nelson, thanks for coming in and being part of this process. My first question is, what do you see as the single biggest challenge facing the University of Minnesota today?
I think if you would have asked me that question a couple of weeks ago, my answer would have been different. But given my professional background, I think the biggest concern that I would want to address today is reputation. And the reason for that is because there was a recent incident, but there's also been many before. And as someone who loves Minnesota and believes in this state and this workforce, I think there's so much good the university is doing, yet there's so much bad that is being talked about. And so I would really like to see more about what is being done, knowing that there are ways to identify risks and address those risks in advance of them happening, and then also to respond in a coordinated and integrated way.
Harriet.
You answered part of my question. From the standpoint of that reputation management or reputation correction, if you will, perspective, you would be in a governance role versus a management role. How would you approach it as a member of the Board of Regents?
So I think I would take my professional experience and apply that perspective in a governing manner. So obviously, I wouldn't be creating the reputation response or the system that they have in place, and I'm not sure what they have in place today, to be honest. But I think I, as the board, would they should be answering questions about what are we doing, and given my background, I would have a very good leg to stand on in terms of identifying whether or not that feels like a good approach.
Other questions? Over to Terry.
Just follow up to that. I share that concern, and I have worked closely with Stacia and can attest to your strong expertise in education policy, so it's great to see you. In terms of how it has been handled over those recent weeks, and I also go back to previous times where the university's reputation has been tarnished, and in particular the psychiatry department with the human subject testing and how that was all handled. What would your roadmap be for recommending a policy in place, and just comments about how this particular situation was handled and any others?
Sure. Well, I think what I can speak to is how I approach reputation management. So I have there's a kind of an anatomy to it. And I would be looking at what's currently in place and finding opportunities to recommend new policies that could either rectify the current process or suggesting other resources that maybe the university should be using outside of policymaking. So with any organization, University of Minnesota or a large company that's very complex, there's really only about 10 to 12 major issues that would change the face of the organization. And I think even though the University of Minnesota is very complex, there's probably only 12. And so really identifying what those are is important. Not knowing what those are puts you at risk inherently. Once you know what those issues are, finding ways to mitigate against those risks. An example of that would be in hiring practices, screening in depth for previous misconduct. That is a pretty clear way of prevention, right? So, but there's other steps and other examples. With each of those risks that are identified, there's multiple ways to prevent those risks in each of those. So those steps should be taken. And then monitoring for those risks. So when things start to pop up internally or in social media or in the news media, addressing them right away and getting in front of that. So I have a PR background, so it's all about telling your story and not letting others tell the story for you. And that would not be my role. But as the Board of Regents, I could help be a resource in that manner. And then finally, it's when a crisis truly does happen. And crisis really means changing the face of the organization, not necessarily a smaller thing. How we respond, there should be plans in place and not plans that are shelved and left there for the what-if days, but plans that are practiced and practiced at the executive level. So if executives are practicing those plans, and I worked at Target, I practiced these plans with our highest, most executives. It's important because when you respond, you're integrated, you're coordinated, everyone knows the role, and everyone has a clear decision-making process, so that process happens quickly. And once you've practiced one scenario, you're pretty well prepared for others.
Margaret.
We haven't met, but one of my mantras in consulting is clear, crisp, and compelling. So first, a compliment. You get some of the most crisp, clear, compelling answers that I've heard thus far.
Thank you.
Which does go with your reference checks. They say that's your greatest strength. But, we ask the good reference checkers, say, and what could be an area of improvement? And one of your references, who knows you very well, says you can be too quick to decide. So if you could wind the clock back, give us an example that you're not breaching any confidentiality that you'd say, let's do a do-over. Because that's the essence of what the university needs to think about as well, is what happened and what would we do if we could do it again.
Yeah, so I think with every personality trait, there's a positive and a negative, right? So when you're someone who likes clarity and conciseness, The flip side of that is that you can sometimes oversimplify and assume the answers are clearer than they actually are. And so knowing that that is a flip side of that personality trait is a good thing to know about oneself. And so, yes, there's definitely been incidences in my past where I think something is pretty clear, and then I learn as I dig into it, well, this is not as clear as I thought. And eventually you get through it and you work it out. So an example of that would be when I joined the Wyndham Community Council most recently, and I thought I'm going to be a community member and lead events, and then they came to me and asked me to be chair. So we really have this board that's divided, and they need to heal. And I'm like, I didn't come here to help a board heal. This, I came here to plan events for my community. But okay, so that doesn't sound that complicated. We'll try that. So I did, and I thought, well, I'll work with these two individuals who really had the issue, and then the board was kind of aligned behind them. I thought, well, we'll just. I'm a person who forgives very quickly, and so I hoped that that would be the case, and that they would find amends. And they didn't, and it was really difficult to get them to talk to one another, to get them to work together. And actually, once I got them to that point, which was great, then the other board members who had sort of created their alignments were not on the same page. And so I think the way I've handled that in the past is trying to express patience, trying to come with two ears and one mouth to really hear all of the facts of the situation. And take baby steps. So I've learned in life that we're all going to be here tomorrow, and we'll just take it one step at a time. Not everything happens quickly. I am a person who likes to get things done, but that's not always the way you can do it. And I'd rather do it right than do it quickly.
Other questions?
Lois.
Can you tell us what the Minnesota Project is, please?
Yes, the Minnesota Project was an organization founded by Governor Dayton, actually, 20-some years ago. It was an organization. It actually has dissolved, and part of it has been adopted by another organization. So it was an organization that really was evolved around energy and environment and agriculture. And so it's kind of this three-tiered organization. And a lot of what they focused, so one of their signature programs was called the Minnesota Tree Project, something like that. It was about tree conservation, and all these apple trees were planted all over the state. And a lot of people don't know how to care for their apple trees or don't use their apples. So, for example, some old apple orchards were turned into golf courses, and the golf courses don't want the apples. So they would go and organize volunteers to pull those apples and then bring them to Second Harvest. So it's that was kind of the agriculture side of it. There was also a sustainability side of it. And the tree program continues on, and other programs were actually adopted by different organizations.
You mentioned one is Fresh Energy. Did Fresh Energy have its roots there?
I don't think Fresh Energy had its roots there. They may have adopted some of their programs, because I know that they dispersed, but I wasn't actually on the board when that disbursement happened, so I couldn't be sure.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Kathy.
Thanks. You mentioned that the most significant challenge now is reputational risk management issues. What would it have been 3 weeks ago?
So I would have said before that STEM-based education and getting, and this would be a second priority for me, and one that I would hope that we could move on to very quickly once we address some of the reputational concerns. I actually work for a technology company today, and I work with a minority woman in technology. And so I have anecdotal evidence, but also background evidence from education policy research that there are far too women in the STEM career paths, and even fewer at the executive level. And we at the university could address that in a lot of ways. So we know that it starts in K-12. We know it starts at pre-K even. But higher education is where a lot of women, I think, are falling out of that STEM career path because, I won't say why, because I don't know for sure why, but I think that there's things we could do. For example, coaching women. So career counselors are a big component of your college experience, right, and what they encourage you to explore and consider. So not encouraging women not to go into STEM or even encouraging them to consider STEM paths. I think is one component. Another is when women are in STEM, it's really important to have a cohort of support to get through those tough classes, to have people that you can lean on, to have study buddies, that kind of thing. So I think we should be creating an infrastructure of support for them. And then finally, I would say mentors are huge. So I think a lot of women, even in business today, don't have executive leadership that they can look to in the STEM fields, and I think that's very discouraging. So to connect students at that level with those that are already in the field will help create that pipeline of mentorship. Mentors have been huge for me. I'm in communications and PR, so it's different. But Karen Himley and Kathy Thunheim are women who adopted me when I was here at the Capitol, actually, and said, we believe in you. And that has been huge for my career. And I think that there are so many women who don't get that. And not just women, minorities, and even men. I think a lot of people don't get that, and it would be very good if they did.
Very good. Jim.
Thank you for applying. I might note that I think that you're perhaps the youngest or one of the youngest applicants, so thank you for doing that. That's a credit to you that you're willing to take this on at an early in your career. Your professional career is very much focused on public relations and communications. What advice as a board member or as a regent would you give the administration or the board chair about communications and public relations?
Well, I would say that when you represent the University of Minnesota, whether you're the president or any other leader, you represent the organization. So stepping out and being your own voice while speaking on behalf of the University of Minnesota is not a wise decision. I think that to the point I made earlier about preventing crises situations, I would strongly encourage any executive to be part of that planning process, because I think that it takes, there's an old saying, right, 20 years to build up a reputation and 2 minutes to destroy it. And I would like the university to focus more on the good that they're doing, but it's hard to do that when the rhetoric is the bad. So my advice would be to get our ducks in a row to prevent the bad so that we can focus on the good.
Kathy.
I already asked.
You did it. Okay, you didn't have another. Okay. Jim, I thought you were going to also go through the logistics of
I guess
process
goes. My semi-standard question. That's right. And it has to do with what your personal relationship with your own state senator and state representative and then others at the Capitol. You referenced maybe, you said over here, do you have some background working in or around the Capitol and then going back to your own legislators who will be important in any campaign that you pursue?
Yes, so I have a lot of relationships with elected officials. I was here for 5 years, so I think over that course of time you just develop a lot of relationships, especially in education policy. I also, towards the end of my career at the Chamber, also represented healthcare policy and small business policy. And so I have relationships with especially those that are in those areas. I just moved, actually. So I moved from South Minneapolis in the Windham community, and now I'm in St. Paul. So I think my representative, this is like a trick question because I just moved 2 months ago and I haven't. So I think it's Representative Mariani and Senator Pappas, right?
Yes.
Okay. And I have great relationships with both. They're both, so Senator Pappas was the chair of the Higher Education Committee in the Senate when I was a lobbyist, and Carlos Mariani was, Representative Mariani was the chair of the K-12 K-12 Policy Committee? Or was he Finance? Okay, yeah. And so he was actually one of the people I work most closely with to push for the Alternative Teacher Licensure Bill, which is one of my proudest career achievements.
Mine too.
I guess a follow-up on that would be, well, then you're very familiar with knocking on doors in this building and across the street, and
yes.
And that's what you'll be doing for a couple months if you're recommended. What can you do positively besides your own candidacy on behalf of the university and talking to that cadre of legislators that you'll talk to? What would your message be as both an applicant on your own behalf and to educate them on what your view of the university.
You're asking before being selected?
Well, I mean, if you are recommended, you're going to talk to a number of legislators. They're going to want to know about you, but you'll have the opportunity to talk about the university.
Mm-hmm.
So what would your message be to legislators besides your own candidacy?
Great question. So I think I've learned from working with legislators, again, and this is just my approach, I think, in life because I know my faults. I would probably start the conversation out with a brief introduction like I shared with you all about who I am and what I think I bring to the table, which is a perspective of a younger woman, very close to recently paying tuition and still paying tuition and knowing the pains of that and being having a young family. And also the focus on reputation management and I think interest in the STEM area. But I would probably actually, being so new, not tell them what I think the university should be. I would probably ask them what their thoughts are.
And Lois?
The university, as you know from your work with education at the Chamber, is one of three segments of higher ed in Minnesota with Minnesota State and the privates. Reading between the lines, I would be inclined to think that the Chamber would have been good foundation from which to learn about all three of those segments and to shape some thoughts about how education in general could be better through collaboration. Would you like to share any of your thoughts in that regard? And might some of those come into discussion as a member of the Board of Regents were you so elected?
Are you asking specifically about all the systems working together?
Right. Or? Is there, as you learned about them, and you've been part of two of them, what are your thoughts as to how, if Minnesota-based education could be the very best that was available, and if our singular land-grant institution were, in essence, at the helm of that, what could the sandbox look like? What do you think it should look like? How might they interface, et cetera?
Okay. So this is not a question I anticipated or thought through, so I'm going to just kind of speak from what I'm thinking. And I don't know what the players look like today because it has been 8 years since I was lobbying on education. At the time, there were a lot of collaborative opportunities where higher education was getting together with other higher education and K-12 was getting together with other K-12. There wasn't a lot of K-12 and higher education meshing, which is an area of improvement I would have recommended, or I would like to see happening differently. I don't know if that's still the case today, because I think the pipeline is one of, it's a continuous one. Right, for the student and for parents, and it's not this disconnected one that we think of as parts of an institution. So I think that pipeline needs to be more seamless, and I know at the time there was concerns that higher education was saying that students coming out of high school weren't actually prepared for their classes, but then I think there was probably a flip side of that where K-12 would say, well, we don't even know what you're asking for. And so where is that connection, right? Where is that communication to create that that continuity? So in addition, I think it would be interesting to also think more about how we connect with the business side of things at the tail end. And that, of course, brings my Chamber background in, because I think having been in the workforce, having worked directly with business, with the Chamber and the business partnership, knowing that education and workforce quality is such a big concern, but not really knowing what necessarily that means. What are the quality issues? What are we seeing? I would love to know more about that and bring the business community into some of those conversations.
Jerry.
Maybe a little more specific, but I'd be interested in your approach. You know, the university is a big, complex engine with a large budget, you know, $3.5 billion, a significant amount of the money, the resources, the personnel, the time and energy is spent on the academic health center and medical education. And this school, going back a few years, was ranked in the top 10 medical schools in the country and probably in the world. In the last year or two, there are publications saying that we now rank 120th or some such things, much lower. Mm-hmm. So how do we go about fixing that status?
Boy, well, are the rankings the same, do you know, as before? Are they the judgments in terms of how
it's... There's multiple different sources of this, depending on who you read, but okay. There's no doubt the ranking and the mm-hmm. reputation, as you
the
put
reputation,
it,
yep.
of this school is much lower
yeah.
than, say, that, let's just throw out 20 years ago. So
I would really question, I would want to know, is it the quality that has gone down, or is it the way in which we're being measured that has changed? Because as someone who has done a lot of research and knows a lot about rankings, and in fact I did like awards and rankings for businesses where it's Fortune's Most Admired rankings, and everybody looks at that, but that's actually how you're judged on that is very, it depends a lot on the different survey or the award. So I would love to know more about how, why are we not ranking? What specifically have we fallen on? And has the quality within those rankings actually changed? We do want to rank high because it is important for reputation. But are there ways that we can increase our ranking by either reporting better data or by engaging in rankings that better reflect what the intention of the medical school is? Does that answer your question? Does that make sense?
What I'm getting at is how to fix the issue.
Well,
I'm not sure you're going to have that, and that's kind of the loaded question part of it.
So. Oh, I see. It's a trick question.
By the way, I'm a graduate of that medical school, so I've a vested interest.
Yes, sure. And I don't know what rankings within the medical school are, so I'd have to know more about what the rankings are. And you're right. I don't know how to address that, but I think the point is with any ranking, whether it's medical school or anything else, there's measurements and there's data behind all those pieces of why you're ranked, right? And so what I would want to look at, and I'm a details person, is what's within those rankings. Have we gone down? Have other people just gone up? And what specifically, what are the areas where we're falling down? And how does that play into what our goals are as a medical school? Is that because I don't think we should make decisions about the University of Minnesota or the medical school in particular because we want to rank high. I think we should make them because they align with our goals as an organization and the direction we're going. But I do think it is important from a reputation perspective to do well on those rankings. I just don't think that should be the guiding post for us.
Okay.
Good. Margaret.
Whenever I look at a resume, I look at two things. I look at professional experience and governance experience. I think you have very good governance experience for your age, because you are one of our youngest candidates, as Jim said. You've segued from two very large companies to your own business. Who are your clients, if you can tell us? And what is the nature of your consulting?
Sure. Yes, I started my own business almost 2 years ago. Not anticipated. I was part of the Target layoffs. And I had the unique opportunity of, within 2 months of the layoffs, I had two past colleagues call and ask if I would consult for them. And I thought, well, I guess I'll do this just until I find the perfect job. And I ended up loving it. So those two calls were from a past colleague that was working with American Express and Cargill, and another colleague who works a lot with Nike. And so those were my first clients, and they still remain clients today. I also work very closely with Medtronic. That's the technology company that I was referring to. And I don't think I'm breaching anything by sharing that with this group, because I'm not putting the logo out there or anything. But I primarily work with Fortune 500 companies. I would say, and the reason for that is what I'm good at is navigating complex organizations. Because communicating and creating strategy is about 10 to 20% of the job. The complexity comes with finding support.
Excuse me, Tayshia.
Okay. Finding support for and creating collaboration within those organizations. That's the tough part.
I'm impressed with your client list. I don't have a client list like that, and I'm a consultant.
Thank you.
Corey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and let me echo my colleagues here and thank you for coming. In your opening statement, I believe it was, you mentioned some of the tuition issues and the pressures on students with tuition rates. As you thought about this, and that being one of your major concerns, what are some of the strategies that you think the university could employ to address those cost pressures on students on either the expense or the revenue side?
Great question. Yes, this is definitely something that I'm concerned about. I think most people are. I want to learn more about the tuition, the reason for the tuition increases. I don't think necessarily that the university has such a high tuition necessarily. I think the tuition issue is beyond just the university. I think for me personally, given that I have, $60,000 in student loans, I'll just be honest about it. The biggest concern is actually the interest rate at the federal government. And I am really wondering if the university and other institutions can help with being advocates for a change at that. I can get a car loan for 1%. I have excellent credit. I can get a house for less than 4%. But my student loan is almost 8.
That's
and
insane.
It is a lot of money over time. And I think that's actually where the rub is. And if we could help remove some of the other issues like those ancillary issues are actually really big issues. So the $50,000, $60,000 isn't the issue. It's the $80,000 in interest over 20 years. And I'm probably not doing the math correctly, so please don't check me on that. But it's a lot of money. I think, though, at the university level, one of the things that we should be looking at, and I'm guessing this is already happening, is where are there ways to cut costs to reduce the cost to students without negatively impacting the education quality and experience that they have. So if there's ways to do that, we should be doing them.
Thank you. Paul.
Stacia, first let me sincerely apologize for butting in and your answer to Margaret, but it brought to mind a compliment that I echo. You've done a wonderful job with Stacia Nelson Enterprises in 24 months. And so I would hope that you will be as successful as Margaret and my very good friend Dave Mona was 40 years ago when there was no snow and Toro had to shut down their PR department. And it became Mona Meyer McGrath and Gavin and now Shandwick International. So keep up the good work.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Theo.
Yeah, thank you for coming here today. So a big issue for me is academic freedom and freedom of speech on campus. We've had a lot of issues with it with the University of Minnesota. One event culminating about a year ago actually led to negative national news coverage. So what role do you think freedom of speech and academic expression have at the University of Minnesota?
This is what I've been personally struggling with lately, with so much, I think, hate rhetoric going on. I think this is an area that I would love to better know, because I'm sure that there are really great ways to address this. So usually when I don't know how to address something, the way I would look at addressing it is, and I think this is part of being creative, is looking at other models around the country. So what are other states or universities or public places that have this kind of same dynamic going on? What are they doing, and is there anybody that's doing this well, and how can we adapt that to fit our needs? Because I definitely think there need to be parameters in place to protect people, but also to protect the freedom of speech.
Okay. Any other comments, questions?
One more. You talk about this, and I guess it's become my standing question a little bit. About diversity and the underserved people and bringing them to light. And how would you, as a region, how would you have help us with more of a focus on that?
Well, again, I think it goes back to how are we encouraging when people are in to the university, or even just looking at who gets in, right? How are we encouraging that pipeline from K-12 education into the University of Minnesota, so that people aren't getting stuck in these gaps, or when they get into the university, they're not being left behind. You know, one of the personal experiences I had I went to Hamline for my undergraduate experience. I had an amazing small kind of college experience where I had a really close career counselor to help me navigate what classes I needed to take so that I could graduate in 3.5 years and still finish, figure out how to study abroad. Because I was paying my own way, I didn't want to pay that extra semester. When I went to the University of Minnesota for Humphrey, I didn't have anybody like that to help me navigate. And I think it's important that we have really good coaches and career counselors in place to not necessarily handhold, but advise. I think in life, you need advice from people who know more than you to help navigate complex systems. If this is complex for all of us, can you imagine being an 18-year-old coming to school for the first time and just wanting to get their degree? I mean, how are we helping, especially, I think, more low-income and minority students who haven't had a role model in their life or a parent who's super involved necessarily? My parents weren't super involved because they never went to college. And so having someone help me through that was really important. And so I think it would be really helpful to have other students who have the same experience have more support through that process. Keeping them in is important too. So,
Jerry?
Just one last question. Again, going back to the thing that you're dealing with a very large, complex institution with lots of underlying issues, and as you mentioned, maybe some negative or bad rhetoric. So with all those things in mind, why do you want to do this?
Well, I don't think those negative things impact my decision. The reason why this is really public service, right? I don't know about the other candidates, but I'm not getting paid when I'm serving. I'm actually giving up money when I'm serving, as you know, as a consultant. So it's a big decision, right? 20 to 40 hours a month, that's adds up pretty quick. But I will say that I think it is a public service decision. I think I have a lot to offer. I also think I want to be a leader, whether that's a leader of my own business or a leader in the public. And I think this is an incredible way to learn about leadership and also learn how to be a great board member. So I love being on boards, and I will continue to be on boards after the regent's role. I probably won't be in any others if I served, because that would be a big commitment. But I would love to learn about how boards can work in a really good way. I think this board works really well, so I can apply those to future boards in my service. And also, I think that there's a lot of things that can be done. And I learned this because I was 22 and dug into education policy and learned there's all these things we could be doing that nobody was doing yet. And I thought, well, if this is all available and out there, and it's just taking the time to figure it out and be creative about it and get out of the box of the same things we've always done, I think I can do that for the university.
Thank you. That's a positive note to end on.
Mr. Chair, I didn't want it to be part of the interview, but we passed a law that allows students to refinance their loans at the credit rate of the state of Minnesota. So you
yes.
can contact the Office of Higher Ed.
My accountant told me that.
But it also brings to mind, this has happened several times in the course of this discussion, we pass laws and nobody communicates them. And so we have a problem in our state. So
thank you. Well, I am happy to announce I think I'm paying off my loans this year. So,
good.
Well, Stacia, thank you so much for being here. Any closing comment?
Again, I just want to reiterate, this is a huge honor. And thank you all for taking the time that you take. I know 17 interviews is a lot. It's probably very exhausting. I hope that this process goes as it's supposed to go. I think it's a really well-vetted process. And so thank you for taking the time and including me in your consideration.
Thank you very much. Happy New Year.
Thank you. You too.